On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. On Monday morning, tensions ran high at the Democratic Convention as DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz resigned amid harsh criticism from supporters of Bernie Sanders. But by Monday night, many thought that Sanders himself had helped to heal the burn and to bring the party together before the historic roll call vote last night that made Hillary Clinton the first woman to be nominated for president by a major political party. From a convention that included some major FaceTime by some of Maryland's most prominent politicians, we are joined this morning by John Fritzi of the Baltimore Sun for analysis of the first 2 days of the Dems. Then Nathan talks to National Aquarium Director John Rocconelli about the best place for the aquarium's dolphins, and our resident foodie Sasha Wohlhandler talks tips for salads with an international flair. Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Maryland Morning starts right after the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The Democrats opened their convention on Monday morning under the cloud of revelations courtesy of WikiLeaks that the Democratic National Committee had cooked the process for the Clinton campaign. On Monday night, Bernie Sanders delivered a strong endorsement for Hillary Clinton, for which he was rewarded with a roll call vote that demonstrated the depth of his support. Michelle Obama offered a deeply personal account of her family's time in the White House. And last night, Bill Clinton offered a robust personal reflection on his relationship with the woman he says people may know only in caricature.
Well, if you win elections on the theory that government is always bad and will mess up a two-car parade, a real changemaker represents a real threat. So, your only option is to create a cartoon alternative, then run against the cartoon. Cartoons are two-dimensional. They're easy to absorb. Life in the real world is complicated, and real change is hard. And a lot of people even think it's boring. Good for you, because earlier today, you nominated the real one.
Tonight, President Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, and Tim Kaine take center stage around the theme of working together. There are, however, plenty of folks who question how well the Democrats are, in fact, working together. There was plenty of discord in the buildup to Hillary Clinton's historic nomination last night, and it remains to be seen whether or not the Bernie or bust faction of the Democratic Party will rally around her campaign. We'll start this morning with a convention update with Baltimore Sun national correspondent John Fritzi, who was in Cleveland last week and who joins us this morning from Philadelphia. Good morning, John. How you doing?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Doing great, thanks. So Bill Clinton had the marquee speech last night. Do you think he revealed some sort of unknown facts about Hillary Clinton? And do you think that this notion of the real one, a theme that he repeated several times, will that be a lasting theme of the campaign?
Well, it might be. Look, I'm not sure that any individual speech, derives the election all that much. I think the Clinton folks are, of course, very much trying to package her in a more personal way, right? This has been an issue she's had all along. People feel like they can't connect with her, they can't relate to her. The Clinton speech, and I suspect some others will hear over the course of the next couple of days, some of these videos that have been running about her have really been part of a broader effort to humanize her a little bit in a way that often is not done in the national media and when, of course, her opponents are talking about her.
Do you think the Democrats have come together at this point and resolved the big issues that divide the progressive and moderate wings of the party?
I don't think they've fully come together, but I do think there's a split in the Bernie Sanders delegation, and I think that's sort of telling, right? I mean, there are a fair number of Bernie Sanders people who walked into this convention saying, look, I'm going to vote for Clinton either way. It's just a matter of how hard I work for her. And so for them, what this convention is about from the Clinton perspective is trying to get them energized and excited. The folks who are basically saying, look, we're never going to vote for Hillary Clinton, they are making some noise and they are getting some attention. But, one of the issues is that you just have this arena that's just full of people. It's a huge arena with all this applause, and everybody's cheering for Clinton. And then you'd have a few hundred people that walk out. They weren't even noticed, really, in the arena. And so there's sort of a telling, I think it's becoming increasingly hard for the folks who say they're never going to vote for Clinton to sort of get attention. In some ways, they're being marginalized even by other Sanders supporters.
Here's a little bit of Elijah Cummings' address to the convention the other night.
I'm proud that our party's platform will help not the wealthy, not the 1%, but instead it will help our struggling middle class, our working families, the disadvantaged and the disabled. It will help the less fortunate. Our platform has passed my father's test, and it has done so not by seeking common ground, but aspiring to higher ground.
John, you wrote about this a couple of days ago, that that's Elijah Cummings speaking to the convention, and you can hear in the background quite clearly people yelling, no TPP, protesting during Congressman Cummings' address. Former Congressman and NAACP Executive Director Kwasi Mfume said on Tuesday, he told you on Tuesday that he thought that the Bernie Sanders supporters at that point were pretty much out of line. There was a little bit of that last night. There was a walkout, as you mentioned. What do you expect looking forward to tonight and then the final night tomorrow night?
Well, the thing with Cummings is a really good example of what we're talking about, right? I mean, you've got these folks who are obviously very upset about this trade agreement, but the timing was off, right? I mean, my sense is that people walked in thinking, all right, Elijah Cummings led the platform committee. The platform committee is where the fight over trade went down. And so it would make sense on a certain level to try to interrupt his speech and chant no TPP through it. But the problem with that calculation is that Elijah Cummings got up and didn't say that much about the platform. And he talked for about 6 minutes very personably about his relationship with his father. It came off a little tone deaf, some people thought. And so that kind of thing, you know, to talk to Mfume, he was making the argument that, look, that doesn't help these Sanders people. If anything, it sort of hurts their cause a little bit. I think the next couple of days is anybody's guess. My assumption is that we'll continue to see things like we saw yesterday with the walkout. I don't see why that's going to stop. The real question is what percentage of the delegates, even the Bernie Sanders delegates, do those folks represent? I'm getting the sense here that it's a fairly small number.
And do you have a sense that the number has stayed fairly consistent from Monday to now? Or is it dwindling at all, or is it increasing at all?
Yeah, it's a little hard for me to say. I mean, I think part of what you'll see as the convention goes on, if the convention is successful, is that some of these folks will come into the fold or might at least moderate or might at least sort of realize that, the alternative is Donald Trump, which, Republicans are obviously supportive of, many of them, but not so much Democrats, right? So I think increasingly, if some of these delegates get a chance to make their concerns known and raise a little hay, that perhaps by the end of the convention they will some of them will come online. Some just won't, right? And some of those folks may never have voted for Sanders or for Clinton to begin with.
John Fritz, he's a national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. He's in Philadelphia covering the Democratic Convention. You're listening to Maryland Morning on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. So Elijah Cummings, one of several Marylanders with a high profile at this convention. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is the secretary of the Democratic National Committee, called the roll call that was the historic moment in which Secretary Clinton was nominated for the first time as a woman, the first time a woman has been nominated to be a major party standard bearer. Barbara Mikulski placed her name into nomination tonight, a coming out party, as it were, for Tim Kaine. You could say that the last few days have been a coming back out party for Martin O'Malley. He has sort of reemerged since his ceasing his campaign in Iowa, you know, what is it, 7 months ago, 8 months ago. What's the deal with that? Why is it, it seems kind of puzzling that Martin O'Malley has had such an incredibly low profile since he dropped out of the race in Iowa.
I'm interested in this story. I think it's a good question. I think part of why it's interesting is that O'Malley and the Clinton family were once really close, right? The Clintons came in and campaigned for him for governor into Maryland several times. Bill Clinton had him on stage as mayor of Baltimore on a number of high-profile events. I mean, they were really a pretty tight relationship there. And I think it's interesting that when O'Malley dropped out after sort of a disappointing finish in Iowa, that he did not immediately rush to embrace Clinton. In fact, he did not embrace or endorse Clinton's campaign until after all the states had voted in June. People noticed that stuff, right? And so, and the Clinton people certainly noticed it. It's not like Clinton really needed O'Malley's support, because ultimately, O'Malley didn't have that much support, right? He didn't finish all that well in Iowa. He never polled all that well. But it's O'Malley's future that I find interesting. You know, what is his next move? He's spent an entire career in elected office. Does he want to get back to do that? Is there some effort or move for him to potentially work in a Clinton administration should he be elected?
And of course,
I just think it's a fascinating story.
Yeah, and of course, the Democratic National Committee rather famously is looking for a new chair, and his name has been bandied about as a possibility. What do you think of that?
I mean, his name has been bandied about as a possibility by people who are close to O'Malley. I think the Clinton, Clinton will ultimately make that call, and I think it comes down to that relationship, and also, what O'Malley could bring to that role. I think he actually could bring something to that role. He pitched himself as speaking to a younger generation. He pitched himself to conservatives, but he's also, twice elected governor of a state, and so he's got establishment ties as well. He knows fundraising. He's an attack dog on television, right? Which is sort of what that job is all about. So I think there's a lot of things that would make sense about it. The question is, does Clinton want him? And that obviously remains to be seen.
John Fritzy is the national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, and he's joined us on the phone from the Democratic Convention in Philly. We'll have more on the convention here on Maryland Morning Friday morning with Farai Chidea from 538 and Michael Fletcher from ESPN's The Undefeated. John, thanks so much. Enjoying your stuff that you're filing from Philadelphia, and we'll talk to you soon. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay tuned to WIPR for complete coverage of the convention with NPR and PBS tonight and tomorrow night. That begins at 8 o'clock. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, Nathan Sterner sits down with National Aquarium Director John Racanelli to talk about the upcoming moves of the dolphins from the Inner Harbor to a marine sanctuary. And Nathan, I'm looking forward to that conversation.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
You're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. Last month, the National Aquarium in Baltimore announced plans to close its 25-year-old dolphin exhibit and move the 8 Atlantic bottlenose dolphins in its care to an oceanside sanctuary, which could be the first of its kind in the U.S. The announcement came after years of protests outside the aquarium, some as recent as May, by animal welfare activists and marine conservationists who argue that it's inhumane to keep intelligent mammals like dolphins captive in tanks and use them for commercial entertainment purposes. For a look at the controversy over keeping dolphins captive and the National Aquarium's plans for its dolphins, we're joined by the aquarium's chief executive officer, ocean conservationist John Racanelli. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Nathan.
You announced that you were considering what to do with your dolphins a couple years ago. I remember telling listeners about it back then during Headlines and Morning Edition. We hadn't heard much during the process, at least I hadn't. Why not?
We'd been quietly doing a lot of homework during that period. When the word came out in 2014 that we were considering it, we still had three alternatives in play. One was to think about continuing to do it right on site. The second was to send the dolphins to other accredited institutions. And the third, the one that we've ultimately chosen, was to create our own sanctuary. We frankly decided that based on the science, based on our understanding of the needs of the dolphins, and based on the fact that somebody needed to take the lead on this, it was appropriate for us to go ahead and create that sanctuary.
Did you feel that it was important for the National Aquarium to be the first to develop a sanctuary?
What was more important to us than being first was getting it right. So in our case, really, we thought about the needs of the dolphins. We thought about our basic mission. And we also gave a heck of a lot of consideration to the impact it would have on our community. And those were three thorny areas that we really needed to work through before we felt like we could say this to the world, that we're going forward with this incontrovertibly.
When you first became CEO of the National Aquarium in 2011, did you have an inkling that you might want to do something about the dolphin exhibit?
You know, I didn't come with the presupposition that we were going to make some kind of major change, but fate intervened. Less than a week after the announcement of my arrival, which was almost exactly 5 years ago, the first of the two calves that were born that spring died. And a week after that, the second one died. And it was a very sad time. And there was, the staff was depressed, the dolphins were depressed, the public was, you know, wondering what was going on. Of course, the dolphin amphitheater was closed.
That was the end of dolphin shows, per se.
That was the beginning of the end for the dolphin shows, yes, because we realized that it was hugely expensive to not to have a dolphin show that was an extra fee and then not be able to do it. But on the other hand, it was incredibly challenging. It was stressful for the dolphins to have to get through a period of mourning, even as there was, the old quote, the show must go on. So the show didn't go on, and we discontinued it for the better part of 6 weeks before it recommenced for a few months. But immediately we said, we've got to find a better model than this. And that led to Dolphin Discovery, which opened in early 2012, and that has been the presage for where we're going now.
The decision to move the dolphins has won pretty widespread approval from animal welfare groups, including PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, a group with a relatively high bar for acceptable animal welfare practices. Dr. Heather Rowley, a wildlife veterinarian with PETA's research and conservation arm, the PETA Foundation, told Maryland Morning senior producer Rob Sivak that she applauds your decision.
What we do know for sure is that captivity kills. Certainly captivity as we know it. So we think it's a monumental move that the National Aquarium is making the decision to let these dolphins out of tanks and put them back in the ocean where they belong. And we hope that in recognizing that, what they're functionally doing is recognizing the fact that these animals really don't belong and they don't thrive in captivity. So we would hope, and actually with any accredited sanctuary type environment, there is a no breeding policy that should come along with that. And that's because we're recognizing, by creating the sanctuary, we're recognizing that there's a problem, that we cannot meet these animals' basic welfare and health needs in captivity, and therefore we shouldn't be propagating it into the future. So we would hope that their sanctuary would also come along with a no breeding model.
That's Dr. Heather Rowley, wildlife veterinarian with PETA, commenting on the aquarium's decision to move its dolphins to a marine sanctuary. John Racanelli, as you alluded earlier, the National Aquarium's dolphin breeding program ended shortly after you began there.
That is true, and our plans currently are that there will be no breeding in the sanctuary. But I have to take issue with just a couple things that Heather said. I don't know her, but I know her by reputation, a very smart person. Thriving is an issue, is a topic that has a lot of play right now. Another term that's used is quality of life for animals. And I think it's important to note that zoos and aquariums throughout the country are really hyper-focused on ensuring ways for the animals in their care to thrive. And what we're learning is there are some species for which that is plausible and possible, and there's other species for which it is not. Could we create a setting where these dolphins could thrive here in Baltimore? Maybe if we fenced off the entire inner harbor and put a biodome over it. But even then, we'd be cheating nature because, again, dolphins are only seasonal visitors to our area. And the only places where they are actually resident are in the warm climates like Florida and further south. So,
and you've certainly chosen to move dolphins there in a place where you think they may thrive better to those habitats.
That is correct. That is correct. But it's also important to note that as we go forward in this evolution of zoos and aquariums, there will always be a place for these kinds of experiences, especially in an increasingly urbanizing world where people are having less and less contact with nature. Urban people, urban kids especially, have very little contact with so-called wild animals. Zoos and aquariums become, in a way, a kind of an urban refuge for those things that provides something that is otherwise not going to be available to these people. And that's an important principle, too.
But you want to make available an opportunity for the dolphins to, as I said, thrive better in the marine sanctuary that you're working to develop. You've said you're looking at sites in Florida, in the Caribbean. What characteristics specifically are you looking for in these sites?
Yeah, great question. A lot of key factors come into play. First of all, size. You obviously want to have a lot more room for the animals to swim and move around and be able to
How much room?
Our exhibit right now in Baltimore is 1.3 million gallons. The sites that we're looking at would be measured in tens or even hundreds of millions of gallons of seawater. And that's another important criterion, is that it has to be seawater as opposed to manufactured salt water, which is what we have here. Why? Well, it just provides a lot more nutrients and a lot more components that are helpful to the animals themselves. They do well in this kind of manufactured salt water, but if we're going to do a sanctuary, it may as well be in real ocean water.
Of course, when you pull in seawater, you also potentially pull in diseases and parasites.
You do pull in pathogens, biota, bacteria. What's really important in this process is something called microbiomes. Everybody has a microbiome associate, every living thing. We both do.
And all the creatures that live inside you, the bacteria, the microorganisms that keep you functioning.
Inside you and on you.
And dolphins have that too.
And that some of it is very environmental. It comes from the environment you're in. So in the process of acclimating the dolphins to the sanctuary, we will be, once we've identified our final site, we will be bringing water from there to here and in increasingly larger gradients.
To acclimate them to the new water they'll be living
in. Exactly right. By the end of their acclimation period, they'll be living in water that mirrors the water that they'll be going to. And that's a very important principle to ensure that the transition is a healthy one.
You've said that this is going to be a protected year-round seaside refuge where dolphins will remain in human care. How will that work?
Well, just as we say, the facility itself will have a resident population of humans as well as the resident population of dolphins, and they'll be the caregivers. The primary function of the facility is going to be, our principle is dolphins first, which means the needs of the dolphins come before other considerations from public display to even research. We do hope to do research. We will have some level of public display, probably in a more discreet kind of viewing area kind of setting, because we possess a public viewing a permit with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. As a public display permit, we have to have some level of public access to them. But that won't be the principal role, and it will be somewhat discreet if we, in whatever context we do it. The main function is to give the dolphins a place to live out their years and to do meaningful research that can help us influence the situation for their wild cousins that live in the ocean.
The facility you're planning would be by the ocean, but not connected to the ocean.
Well, interesting.
Or would it?
Interesting question. It could be either. It could be either. For example, in the Florida Keys, there are these big saltwater lakes that were built when they built the transoceanic railway way back in the 1920s. They carved these things out, used the limestone to build the bridges, and then these filled up with saltwater because limestone is porous. One of those could possibly serve as a good sanctuary. They are hundreds of millions of gallons deep and full. On the other hand, open seawater offers a lot of benefits as well. Natural biota can come in, animals, fish, crabs, crustaceans, etc., all of which gives the dolphins an experience that more closely approximates the real world that they come from. So that's still an open question. We're looking at all those alternatives.
Is there a chance that the dolphins would be able to go out in the ocean itself?
Interestingly, right now, that is not something that we're planning, in part because that's not something that NOAA, the NOAA Fisheries Department, which oversees all the permits for all the marine mammals that are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 72, they don't yet really like the idea of dolphins that were bred and raised in captivity potentially mixing with native dolphins, in part because of concerns about genetic mixing and also the possibility that dolphins that come from human settings where they've been imprinted with humans might teach native dolphins to do the same thing. And obviously, that's not a good thing.
But that's federal regulations. You yourself are not ruling out the possibility, should things change, of these dolphins being allowed to spend some time in the ocean.
You know, our youngest dolphin, Bailey, is only 8. So we hope that she will be in our care for at least 40 or 50 years. It means that there's a long time during which a lot of learning is going to take place. The idea that we could somehow get them out into the oceans, at least doing swims, if not someday being released, is certainly not out of the question. It's certainly a possibility.
You talked about genetic mixing, and you've said that there's not going to be a dolphin breeding program at the sanctuary. How do you stop dolphins from breeding if they want to breed? I understand they're rather sexual animals.
That's true, and there is not a reliable method of contraception at this point in time, except the most obvious one, which I've jokingly called the Catholic method, and that is to keep the boys separate from the girls.
And that's how you do it now?
That's how we do it now.
Different dorms?
Different dormitories, and in this case, there's no windows to climb out of.
That's National Aquarium CEO John Racanelli talking about the aquarium's recent decision to close its 35-year-old dolphin exhibit and move the facility's 8 bottlenose dolphins to a marine sanctuary by the year 2020. And I should note that Mr. Racanelli is also the host of A Blue View, a weekly radio program about marine life produced by the National Aquarium, broadcast here on WYPR during All Things Considered. What roles do you think zoos and aquariums should be playing in educating people about animals in the future?
The role of zoos and aquariums is evolving and will continue to. And in fact, it is really an emerging concept that zoos will become sanctuaries in their own right, places where species that are at risk in the wild might find sanctuary while we, one hopes, get our act more together to provide native settings for those animals in the future. Now, that second part is very important because that requires all kinds of public policy changes and political cooperation between nations. That said, it also is becoming clear that to serve our kind of desire to have a personal kind of experience with certain animals, and I number among them the so-called charismatic megafauna, the big mammals, dolphins, whales, elephants, even the big cats. It's harder and harder to justify that, especially if they're living in a setting that just doesn't come anywhere close to the native setting that they might come from. A good example is recently a zoo in Houston gave up its polar bears, sent them to Detroit, where they've built a beautiful habitat for polar bears. It has a chilled lake. It has actual ice floes that are refrigerated in a climate where polar bears would tend to be found in nature. It's a smart idea. The Detroit Zoo is making its specialty those kinds of animals, and yet they also gave up their elephants because elephants don't live in cold climates.
One more question. Longevity of the sanctuary. Bottlenose dolphins live 40 to 50 years. Your oldest dolphin's 44 years old, so towards the end, but your youngest, as you said, just 7. That's a decades-long commitment, assuming no other dolphins join the sanctuary, which you've said you are open to.
We are open to it. We do anticipate that there probably will be others, although I should stress that we haven't had any direct requests. Also, in the fullness of time, I anticipate that the facility will become more of a rescue, rehab, and release operation as well. It's impossible to build a place where you've got veterinarians and people with talent and food and all the necessary ingredients and not end up in the rescue business. And frankly, that's a good thing. I'm happy to be contributing to an ongoing evolution of that kind of service for the nature.
2020 is the target open date for this sanctuary. John Racanelli is the CEO of Baltimore's National Aquarium. Thanks for joining us this morning, and good luck with the dolphins.
Thank you so much, Nathan. Good to be here.
We've got more information about the National Aquarium's dolphin policy on our website. Come to WYPR.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. It's time now for What You Got Cooking.
How's about cooking something up with me?
And
once again, we touch base with our resident foodie, Sasha Wohlhandler. Sasha and her husband, Steve Susser, run Sasha's 527 Restaurant and Catering on Charles Street in Mount Vernon here in Baltimore. Today, Sasha, you have some tips on salads, I guess, that incorporate traditions of different cultures around the globe.
Well, you know, Tom, when you always ask me so kindly to come and chat with you about food, which I love, I always look for a little inspiration of what to talk about. And this time I was sitting in the Charles Theater watching the previews, and Yo-Yo Ma came on with that great preview of his Silk Ensemble.
The Silk Road Ensemble. Yeah. I didn't get to see that movie, but
neither
yeah.
did I, but yeah. it looked fabulous. But what he said was he wanted to take music to all the different cultures. He thought it was a great vehicle, and I thought, what's my thing? And I realized, food, what could be a greater ambassador?
And of course, food, you know, now cities around the world, you can get foods from every different culture. And here in Baltimore and in Frederick and in Hagerstown and Annapolis, there are, you know, foods from, you know, it's available to you to have all sorts of different things. But we're going to talk specifically about salads, I guess, right?
Exactly, because we're all going to cookouts, and in between our hot dogs, hamburgers, and fried chicken or grilled tofu, let's bring some international salads to these potlucks that we have. So, want to start with the Middle East?
All right, let's start with the Middle East. What do you got?
Well, you know, it's funny. Years and years ago, when I traveled through Romania and Bulgaria and went on to Turkey and Israel and then Lebanon, this was many years ago. It wasn't so difficult to travel with all the problems we have these days. I got into chopped salads. If you go into the Middle East, and you know Sasha's is famous for our chopped salads, but they do their chopped salads. It's tomatoes, cucumbers, onions, and then you go from there. For example, fattoush. Fattoush is really Lebanese answer to the Italian panzanella, and what they do is they've taken the tomatoes, the cucumbers, tons of little chintzes of garlic, and tons of parsley and mint and fresh lemon juice, and a tiny bit of olive oil, tossed it all together, and then they put dried pitas into it, crispy pitas. So that's
right into the salad.
Right into it. So you know that panzanella, that tomato salad. I didn't put any pitas in that because it's also the base for tabbouleh, which in the summer you cannot taste a fresher salad.
Oh, sometimes some fattoush, it was delicious.
Isn't that wonderful? And it is, for those of you that are working to be figure friendly, tomatoes, cucumbers, onions, and then toss it with a ton of parsley. If you want to put basil, you want whatever fresh herbs, but the parsley, it's almost a parsley salad.
All of which completely plentiful as we speak in the farmer's market.
It's so beautiful. Yeah. And if you want it, you just add bulgur wheat, which is so easy, folks. Mm-hmm. Boil water. Put your bulgur wheat in. Put the water on top of it, and in 15 minutes, it's done. And toss it with all that wonderful stuff that I just said. Or
that's a meal, too. You don't even, you know,
put
you
some grilled cheese. If you're vegetarian, it's a fantastic meal. If you want to add feta to it, it's fantastic. Grilled shrimp on top. If you want to put any kind of grilled anything on top, all of your kebabs, anything at all. Isn't it wonderfully fresh? It's that parsley that is so fantastic. You don't like bulgur wheat? Put the quinoa in. Make it all more updated. It is a really spectacular way to go.
And we'll have recipes for the quinoa and all that kind of stuff. All right, so that's terrific. How about this Lebanese tomato salad?
Well, the Lebanese tomato salad, it came to me years ago when I have a close friend from Lebanon, and she took salt and pepper and some garlic and made sort of a paste in the bottom of a big wooden bowl. She put chopped up tomatoes, tossed it all in that, and said, don't touch it for an hour. And I said, oil, vinegar? She said, no, just leave it. It's wonderful. All that pulled out the juices of the tomato, and then she tore some fresh basil into make a tomato salad. It is fantastic.
With no oil and vinegar.
No oil and vinegar. If you want to, you can, but you do not have to.
Mm-hmm. Of course, and with Middle East, you could also serve hummus. You could make your own, or you could buy it at the farmer's market or any number of other places.
Exactly.
Okay, let's move on to Asia. You have some beautiful Asian ideas.
Well, our friends from Asia, I mean, we have all become... After all, these days, it's salt, pepper, and can we have some sriracha? Or how do you say that? Gauchuang. I forgive me, folks. I don't know how to say the Korean new hot paste that we're all getting so familiar with. But we have just become wedded to the wonderful flavors of ginger, garlic, sesame, soy, mirin, basil, cilantro. It is fantastic. This time, when you go to one of your potluck cookouts, why don't we take a great Asian coleslaw? Right there, I think I have a Thai one. And I made a vinaigrette with lime juice, olive oil, sesame seed oil, soy sauce, some brown sugar, fresh ginger, garlic, a little chili, and a bunch of cilantro and basil. Is that scrumptious.
Again, all that stuff very readily available at the farmer's market.
I mean,
it's just great to mix it up a little bit.
This is wonderful. Asian, you've got that Asian salad, flavor. Yeah. I love to add some fresh peaches to that. I love to add some mango to that. Sugar snap peas, cucumbers. Folks, just let your imagination go outside the box.
And again, you could put anything on top of it, too, as we were talking about with the
grilled
Middle Eastern
shrimp.
Style. Shrimp,
that
chicken.
Would be that with a bed of grilled shrimp or grilled salmon or any kind of grilled fish, grilled chicken.
Just don't put those little cocktail hot dogs on it because that would be tacky.
Don't talk to me about a hot dog, Tom. You know I love a hot dog with just about anything on it. We're going to get off track.
Off the subject. All right. So we've got that beautiful Asian teriyaki coleslaw. And again, we'll have all of this on the website to be sure. How about something called elote? What's that?
Well, now we're moving to another international destination of a place that has brought us so much happiness, Mexico. I mean, our friends from Mexico, they salsa. What little kid isn't screaming, ketchup, ma? No, I want the salsa. What little kid says, I don't want a grilled cheese. Give me a quesadilla. So elote is...
And salsa, of course, is one of those things that there, I mean, there are recipes for it, but you could just
tomato.
Really find whatever is fresh and throw it in there and
get
you're done.
Get your tomatoes, get your onions, get your bell peppers, chop them all up, put a bunch of cilantro, some lime juice, as many chilies as you want it hot, and there are as many recipes you want. Chop it all up by hand, folks. You can make your own salsa. You don't need to buy it in a jar. You want to get fancier? Take those tomatoes out and put peaches. Put fresh mango. You've got mango salsa. Put it
on. But still with the lime juice and stuff and the cilantro. That's the thing that's
going
to make it
happen. Put it on anything. Salsa is fantastic. But elote, which is so fantastic, either grill or boil your corn any which way you want. Then take it off the cob, run a knife down and get some of that good corn milk in it as well. Put it in a bowl. Put a ton of cilantro, some scallions, some red onions, some chilies, some red pepper flakes, a touch of cumin. I put some goat cheese in there just because I'm a little goat cheese crazy. You could also put blue cheese.
That's a good touch. Yeah.
And then fresh lime juice and olive oil. You can also, I like to keep it light, so that's why I did it that way. You can also do it with mayonnaise and chili powders and chilies and do it with mayonnaise. I like to keep the mayonnaise away, but is that not delicious?
Terrific. Great ideas to give international flair to any kind of meal that we're serving, whether it's a barbecue or just eating these salads on their own right.
In the end, I just want to say, we welcome diversity. It's our country. Bring one of these international salads to your next potluck. But above all, folks, we've had a rough June and July. Let's break bread with your friends and neighbors. And that bread can be French. It can be pumpernickel. It can be Italian. It can be Middle Eastern pitas. It can be tortillas. It can be lavash focaccia. We can go on and on. Dip it in some honey. Spread the joy. Food. It's all about humanity.
It is indeed. Well said. Sasha Wollhandler and her husband Steve Sisser own Sasha's 527 restaurant and catering on Charles Street here in Baltimore. Come on over to our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. We'll have some of the recipes we talked about this morning. Thanks, Sasha. See you next time.
Great, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up Friday morning on Maryland Morning, more on the Democratic Convention with Farai Chidea of 538 and Michael Fletcher of ESPN's The Undefeated. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great day.